This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hi everyone, it's Connor Boyle here. Before we get into this week's episode, there's something I'd love you to give a try. We've just launched a new online streaming platform, Intelligence Squared Plus. It's packed with over 20 years of our debates, and whether you want to tune in live and watch along and ask your questions or watch back on demand, everything is totally ad-free and there's endless hours of discussion to dive into. The usual price is £14.99 a month, but we want to give you, our podcast listeners, a special offer to give it a try. For 10 days only, we're offering a subscription for only £10 a month, and the offer ends at midnight GMT on Tuesday, 20th December. Get it while you can. So if you want to join the Intelligence Squared Plus community, visit intelligencesquaredplus.com or click the link in the episode description to subscribe and use the discount code MONTH10 or ANNUAL10 to start watching today. Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. Today on the podcast, we're taking a look at the internet's new favorite toy, ChatGPT. This is some of AI's most impressive work yet, but could the creation of an all-knowing human-like chatbot, a tool which can create answers, emails, poems, stories, and essays instantly, mean that writing as we know it could cease to exist? To explore this question, we're joined by novelist and essayist Stephen March and academic and broadcaster Shahida Bari. Here's Shahida with more.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Shahida Bari. Whenever new AI technology comes around, first there's marvel and awe, and then we ask ourselves which jobs, professions, and entire skill sets are going to be replaced or potentially erased. Just a few months ago, the artificial intelligence research laboratory OpenAI released DALL-E 2, an updated version of their AI image generator, prompting graphic designers to ask if this marked the end of their careers. What a designer could spend weeks working on, DALL-E could instantly conjure up with a prompt in the search bar. And now, while the artists take stock, it appears that it's time for the humanities to panic. A couple of weeks ago, OpenAI unleashed its latest creation into the world, ChatGPT. This new tool has captured people's attention, most particularly in its ability to simulate natural language, language that no one would suspect of having not come from a human. Using an immense amount of data which has been downloaded from the internet, ChatGPT has been programmed to instantly respond to questions and tasks, arguably better and clearer than any human could in the given time. It can write corporate emails and cover letters, TV scripts and poems, even an imaginary Twitter spat between Donald Trump and Shakespeare. Yours if you ask for it. In the first 5 days of its launch, ChatGPT reached 1 million users. But while impressive and entertaining, what could this kind of technology mean for the way we learn to write and communicate? What's going to stop students, for instance, asking this incredibly smart search engine to do their homework, write their essays, think critically, and communicate effectively for them? I'm sure we would all have wished for a friend like ChatGPT at some point in our education, but what does it mean now that it's here? I'm joined now by novelist, essayist, and cultural commentator Stephen March to discuss whether writing is a dying skill, the future of academia, and the widening schism between humanists and technologists. Stephen, hello. Welcome to Intelligence Squared.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. This feels like a super interesting and slightly terrifying conversation. You've been playing around with ChatGPT over the past few days, along with millions of others. What kinds of things have you been asking of it?
Well, I actually haven't used ChatGPT because I've been using GPT-3 in other modes for quite a while. Like I used a program called PseudoWrite, which was sort of a writing software program developed out of OpenAI's GPT-3 almost 2 years ago now. And then I also use Cohere, which is a large language model in Canada. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about this leap forward is that certain brands tend to dominate the conversation. But when you, like, I've been working at this stuff for like 3-4 years now, and it was very clear to me that sort of what everyone is seeing with ChatGPT right now has been very clear to me for at least 2 years that it was going to do all this stuff. I mean, I put into it 2 years ago Kubla Khan by Sam Taylor Coleridge, and it finished it in a very complete and credible way, and I was
really?
Like, oh, that's it. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
What does
credible mean in this sense?
Well, I have a PhD in English. If you were to tell me that Coleridge had written it, I would assume that he had.
Wow. Right?
Like that it was absolutely. And if you told someone, hey, we found a manuscript with this in it and Coleridge wrote it, I don't really believe anyone would not agree. Right. Like it's very, very, very credible. And so when I saw that, I was also fooling around with it, getting to do things like complete, unfinished manuscripts, literary manuscripts that I was very interested in, continuing writing Mystery of Edwin Drood by Dickens and so on. And it did that in very, very credible ways. So, you know, I knew at that point, it was only a matter of time before it could figure out the very crude, 5-paragraph essay that we teach in high school in North America, and the 1,500-word undergraduate essay, which I do believe is just doomed at this point.
You've been worried about this for a while, then, it sounds like. But does this new ChatGPT offer any – is this a more sophisticated version, or it's just the more popular version of it, and that's the danger of this one?
It's both. I mean, like, they've obviously channeled it in a very effective way, but it's still GPT-3 base, which is 175 billion parameters. I mean, for example, I got a look at Google's Palm, which is 540 billion parameters, and it can do low-level reasoning. Like, it's freaky. Like, if you explain it to it that, you know, if you have two apples and you add three apples, that's 5 apples. It can then extrapolate a mathematical reasoning from that, right? Through language, right? Through language, not through having calculation input into it. And then, of course, you know, GPT-4 is probably right around the corner. I mean, there's lots of rumors swirling about that. It may have more parameters than there are neurons in the brain. Nobody really knows what that means, what that's going to mean. But, you know, I've had my brain sort of blown away about once every 2 weeks for a
really?
Year with this stuff,
wow.
Right? So like it's not – I'm not worried. Like I mean I think the undergraduate essay as we know it is going to die, but that's not something that worries me. Like I actually think this is incredibly exciting and that there's a lot of creative possibilities behind this. I've used it to write fiction. I've used it as a co-author in fiction.
Really?
That I've published in LA Review of Books here. And, you know, for Lit Hub, I published a entirely auto-generated piece of fiction that was like an idealized love story. I'm using it right now to write prompt fiction. So that'll be like an infinitely regenerative story where it's the same story with the same characters told differently every time. I mean, I genuinely feel like I got early access to this technology kind of by accident. The people who live in my neighborhood happen to be the people who invented Transformer, which is the T in GPT-3. And I sort of feel like I'm playing around with an electric guitar in like 1952. I just think there's going to be really a lot of exciting things to come out of this.
You're going to be our Bob Dylan going electric. But is there with the Coleridge... You're quite like that analogy, Stephen, I can tell. But with the Coleridge,
I think more like Haley
Bill
and the Comets would be closer to it. Bad, early adopter, but good.
But with the Coleridge example, I want to ask you about your own fiction in a moment because that sounds super interesting.
Yeah.
But with the Coleridge, for people who don't know how the technology works, when you say that it sounded like a perfectly feasible Coleridge, lost Coleridge manuscript when it completed the poem Kubla Khan. How is it doing that? Is it, it's calling up an archive that it knows of Coleridge's work? How is it generating this?
Well, I mean, okay, you're going to put me on the spot here. I've talked to the people who've invented this. I've tried my hardest to understand what a transformer is. I just don't want to give the impression that I know what I'm talking about. I've worked really hard. I'm not an idiot. I have a PhD, but like it's, I think I understand about 15% of it. First of all, the important thing to know is that it's only, all it is text prediction software, period. It predicts what is the next word after. That's all it does. And that's really important to keep in mind. So the way that it does that is by analyzing language through a supercomputer. In the case of GPT-3, a billion-dollar supercomputer that OpenAI got from Microsoft that analyzes, I mean, in the roughest estimation, it would be the patterns in language that lead to more coherent outcomes. And it self-teaches that over the parameters. And that's why the number of parameters makes such a big difference in the coherence of the output. So GPT-2 was, I think it was 30 billion, and it could do some interesting stuff. But then once it got to 175 billion parameters with GPT-3, it got that's where you get the Coleridge stuff. And when you get to 540, to me, it's like a completely different level. And then, you know, if we're talking like, and that's why when we get to the next phase of this, which could literally happen next week. I mean, the rumors are that it could drop in December where you're at, I mean, other rumors have it at 100 trillion parameters or whatever. I mean, I don't know if any of that's true, but that'll be equally as drastic a change.
Wow. Wow. Last week, you wrote an essay in The Atlantic titled "The College Essay is Dead." Let's start with what's so important about undergraduate level essay writing. I mean, do you still think essay writing is important?
Look, I make my living basically doing college essays, right? Like I've been doing the same activity since I was about six, fundamentally, right?
Because you're an essayist.
Give topics. I think about them. I write an opening paragraph, which leads into a thesis statement, which is followed by an argument, which is leads to a conclusion, which eases out. I mean, like, it's kind of ridiculous, but like, it's this activity has dominated my entire life, right? And I do think we use it as a frame for how to learn how to think through things, learn how to make arguments, how to research things, but also how to phrase things. And you know, people are like, well, it's just wording. Like, someone was arguing with me about this on Twitter, and they were like, well, all you're doing is wording. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's my whole life. Like, you can treat that like it's not a big deal, but like, putting the words in the right order is actually quite hard to do and requires quite a bit of like learning how to do it, right? Like, when I say it's going to end the undergraduate essay, I mean, like, obviously, there are ways of approach to this that are different, but like, here's an idea. You have a blank page. Go and figure out how to fill it with 1,500 words of thinking. That, I think, genuinely ended last week.
Really?
Right. There's no blank page. If you want filler, you can absolutely get it. Right. And how much of undergraduate essays are filler? I mean, I used to be a prof. It was like at least 99% of what I read when I marked papers, when I graded papers, was filler. Well, GPT-3 just, ChatGPT just pumps it out. Like, click
but what, but what I'm trying to work out, Stephen, is whether you think that is a bad thing. If ChatGPT is going, if the essay died last week because ChatGPT is going to fill student essays around the world, is that, it seems to me you don't think that's such a terrible thing.
Well, I mean, you know, it's something that I love that is dying, right? And certainly something that has shaped me. But, you know, cursive writing is dying too. And like, it was very beautiful too. But, you know, like, I think it's just the way of the world. I mean, what I'm scared about is that the humanists who have shown so little capacity to adapt to the world as it is coming, will fail once again to adapt to this change and will lead themselves into death once again through apathy and their usual blitheringness. I say that as one of them. What I'm worried about is the end of that, for sure. You know, the essay as we've had it as a form really is not that old. Right? Like in the 19th century, all of these colleges, they were all run on oral exams. They were all run on in-class writings. They were not necessarily written on the essay. Like, universities are going to have to adapt in a very big way. Certainly take-home exams are pointless. Why would you even do one?
When you think about something like college admission essays, or in the UK we talk about personal statements, for instance, is this the end of writing as a kind of gatekeeper and a metric for intelligence now, because it's not no longer a trustworthy form. What do you think?
Well, you know,
maybe that's a good thing. I don't know, Stephen.
I think if you're asking people for filler writing and there's a machine that can do it, like, were those essays ever really an intelligent way to gauge people? Like, I'm not really sure that they ever were. I think one thing you have to really remember is that ChatGPT-3, while very impressive, is not going to replace writing. I mean, not at all. Like in no way is it going to do that. But, you know, we live in a world where I receive multiple letters a day that start, "Dear Mr. Marsh, you are one of our most valued customers," right? Like, why would anyone write that down? That's not a meaningful sentence, but it's just language in a box, right? And that stuff, like, similarly to, like, what ChatGPT is going to be unbelievable at is, like, I need a contract for a junior assistant. It can write that like that perfectly. That filler garbage language that so much of our lives are full of, it's going to replace all of that. I think what it will replace is, like, in those college admission essays, you will be looking much more at the content than you are looking at the clarity of expression or just simply like, oh, this person is fluid in their writing, because ChatGPT is perfectly fluid. But also, I see it as something that produces a draft that then you then go and edit. I've never found it to produce, you know, work that you can use out of the box. Never. Right? Like, it doesn't have intention. You know, our language for...
It would give you something to work
on. Yeah, exactly. Like, it's unbelievable at that. Right? Like, it just, like, write a scene that's that, and it's just an idea. But
I'm wondering whether I should have written a script for our conversation, Stephen. I should have ChatGPT'd it and then edited it subsequently. Of course.
Is this a trick?
I'm a bona fide interviewer, and I prefer questions. And no, well, one of the things I do want to ask you is, you know, of course, the essay is a form that has been problematized too. I mean, in the UK, and I imagine in Canada and the US, people talk about the attainment gap. Which happens sometimes along lines, often along racial lines, very often along language lines, if English is a second language and you're being assessed in terms of your acquisition and fluency in English in an essay form, there is often an attainment gap. And it's a problem that we've had to think about in very serious ways. And I wonder whether ChatGPT might be a solution to some of those problems in some ways.
Oh, the opposite. Opposite.
Okay. Tell me.
Because, like, what I mean, like, all of these technological leaps, it's going to favor people who have access to them, right? And people who can manipulate networks better, right? Like, what it would become a metric of is not your voice, but actually, or your, you know, let's say your capacity to mimic, let's take in the English context of a certain class structure of language, right? The ability to mimic that was a certain trick that you had to master to enter, you know, whatever, Oxford, Cambridge, and so on like that. This will just... You know, you will get a machine that can do that, but the trick is you'll have to be able to figure out the machine, right? And you'll have to have access to the machine. And of course, they're going to charge for access to the machine. This is not Google. It's not going to be free. So it's going to require that, just as the same way as any of these processes that claim to democratize anything actually lead to huge spikes in inequality. Also, it's worth remembering, there's no solution to this, so nobody talks about it, but, like, these language models are, like, deeply racist, and, like, they carry the whole weight of, I mean, racist I don't think is actually even the problem. They just carry the whole weight of all of the prejudice that's contained in language. They don't have opinions. They just come out of language, right? And so our language is very based on gender, class, race, all of it. All of those are baked in a fundamental way that we can never, you know, as much as we try, we're never actually going to exculpate any of those tensions, right? So the idea that, like, poor kids are going to use this to get an edge, like, no. It'll be like every other tech. The rich kids will use it to get an edge over the poor kids.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear your prognostication about that.
Do Did you know that wherever you are in the world, you can stream live Intelligence Squared debates and discussions? We've just launched a new online streaming service called Intelligence Squared Plus, where you can tune in to all our upcoming events, ask your questions, vote on motions, and also watch back all our previous events on demand wherever you want. The usual price is $14.99 a month, but for you, our podcast listeners, for just 10 days, we've got a special introductory offer of £10 per month. Visit IntelligenceSquaredPlus.com or click the link in our description and use the code MONTH10 or ANNUAL10 to start watching. Offer ends at midnight GMT on Tuesday, 20th of December, so subscribe today and don't miss out. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
It's been reported that the widely used plagiarism checker Turnitin is unable to detect work that's been produced by ChatGPT. It can usually detect wholesale lifted quotations from Google or whatever, and students' essays flash up with a percentage of plagiarism, which rings alarm bells for the appropriate tutors. But ChatGPT seems to be escaping Turnitin's detection. So does that mean an organization like OpenAI have, does it mean that OpenAI have a responsibility to be transparent about what they're working on and what they've developed before unleashing it on the world?
The reason ChatGPT is taking over the world is that OpenAI has been very responsible for it, to it. Like what it, it's very channeled language, right? Like it's not, it is a, there were versions of this before, like Replica, which was a therapist that it, with very little manipulation, you could get it to convince you to commit suicide, right? They've done a very good job of providing pretty good guardrails with this stuff. So, I mean, I think they deserve some credit. I think they're really trying to be as responsible as possible. And, you know, they do, there are some talk of them marking GPT, ChatGPT text so that it can be, it will register as plagiarism if you check with them, right? And teachers can do that. Also, you know, there's absolutely algorithms that can determine whether a text is AI generated. That's a business for like someone's building right now, I bet, right? Like, and I bet every university will have to buy it in 6 months or whatever, or whenever they decide this is a serious enough problem that they're going to have to pay some money for it. So there are solutions like that, but it's, to me, only an idiot student would just have it generate the whole thing, right? Like that's not, like what you do is you use a bit, then you change a bit, you change it, like you use it as a base. What you don't have to do with this stuff is the first draft. And of course, the first draft is the hardest, hardest bit of any creative project, right? And so like, I don't think, like what you're going to have is not like the actual output of GPT-3 being handed in. I think that'll be for the dumb kids that'll be easy to catch. I think it's like the people who use this as a creative tool, like a thesaurus, like something like that, that's going to be impossible to catch because it will not be text that has existed before or strictly automated text either. And you've automated out the hardest part of the writing process.
Well, when you said the words first draft, I shuddered. The essayist in me is horrified at it. And you were talking about your own writing practice changing. So.
Well, not me. I mean, you know, I'm like a dinosaur at this point. I use but, pens.
But I mean, we are all terrified of the first draft. Is this the end of writer's block? Because, you know, we will just type into ChatGPT our requirements. And then there's a first draft that we can chisel away at, like one of the Bounty sisters.
You know, I mean, the thing that you have to remember, like, I think this is so important. It's so hard for, because of the movies, because we've been, because our discourse is so, about artificial intelligence is so bad, right? And even the term we use for it is so poor, like artificial intelligence, like this is just text prediction, right? It doesn't have intention. It doesn't have will. And a good essay is an act of will above all. Right? It's an act of like, I want to say this. I need to say this. You need to hear this. And that process, you can't automate that. So like, if for me, like when I'm writing an essay, like the essay I wrote for ChatGPT-3, if I were to say, write an essay about ChatGPT-3, it would give me something very filler, but you know, I don't think it would ever go viral. You know, because it would not be new. Right? It's the exact opposite. It would not be new. So this is a tool that we're trying to figure out. I mean, to me, it's like the invention of the turntable, and now we're going to have to figure out how hip hop works, right? Like what we can do with it creatively, what we can do with it aesthetically. I do think like basic forms of writing, filler writing, is going to be damaged, or it's just going to be automated. But like, I don't think that's the end of writing at all.
When you described the characteristics of good writing as intention and will, and bearing in mind how persuaded you are by the future of ChatGPT, how good a dupe is it? Could you read something and believe that this piece of work by an imaginary writer had intention and will? How good a dupe is it?
Oh, I mean, well, look. The piece I wrote for The Atlantic 3 months ago called Gods and Machines, where it was about this stuff before ChatGPT-3, right? Before ChatGPT, it was about GPT-3 and like the different models that I was seeing, and particularly Cohere, which I actually think nobody talks about, but is like every bit as fascinating. And Jasper AI, which is, you know, has a whole suite of tools that you can use on this stuff. This is just the one that's caught the public imagination, right? But like, you know, in that piece, like in the third section, I just had a whole auto-generated text, right? Like, it was generated by a machine. And then at the end of the piece, I say, by the way, this was generated by a machine. And certainly no editor stopped it, right? Like, no editor said, what's going on here? Like, it absolutely, it was not what I believed, but it was like, you would certainly think, oh, that's an Atlantic article. And that was generated just off me having text prediction from like 1,000 words of text.
But how do you feel about that? About Stephen Marsh being a voice that can be replicated via AI like that?
Well, I'm diving headfirst into this. I mean, I love this. I mean, I think we're at the beginning of a new medium. I think we're at the beginning of a new form of art. And I love the essay. And I don't think it's going to make the essay worse. The thing this is really going to damage, it's sort of like with art design. It's like the people who used to cut out pictures and paste them into newspaper fronts and then mail them to printers, like those people aren't going to exist anymore. But designers, like people who want to use this text to build beautiful things, I mean, that's just going to be explosive. And like, I mean, I'm all in. Like, I love this stuff very deeply, and I think it's incredibly powerful. And, you know, I think our technophobia about it is really because we were so punished by social media and our faith in social media, which was so betrayed, like, which is a disaster for everyone. And of course, all the fraud that's coming out of Silicon Valley, like a factory, like we've become sort of
technophobic.
We can't see how beautiful this is. Also, you know, the engineers don't know what the hell they're doing, right? Like, because they have no humanistic education, they don't know anything at all about the language that they're altering. I mean, I had a meeting the other day where I'm talking to an engineer at a text to image generator. And he's like, by the way, you know, we figured out this way of like conjuring characters. Like, you would speak a character and then it would create a 3D image of them that we could project on a wall. Do you think there'd ever be any creative application for that? I was like, I think I could think of a couple that might work for that.
Well, you know, we have been very anxious about the deep fakes in political context, right? Of the vocal fakes, the voice fakes, audio fakes of politicians in particular. That's been an object of real political concern. Could this sort of technology be mobilized for nefarious political ends? Could we have?
Oh my God. I mean, OpenAI's one user agreement that they make you, like the only thing that they make you sign when you use it is that it will not be used for politics.
Right.
They are more than well aware that, once this gets used. But you know, I think we're about to enter a place where, much like the early internet, when you see something, you automatically disbelieve it. And it's only like, and you're like, the credibility of a source, the power of fact checking. Like, one thing that is going to, I believe, is going to explode in, I don't know, I don't like to make these big predictions, but the more I look at it, the more I see like how people are using this stuff. It's like they use it and then they're like, well, is what it says true? Right? Like, if you use ChatGPT to produce some text, it could just be a hallucination. Like, it could have no validity of any kind, right? And like, then you have to go, like, immediately after you conjure these paragraphs up, you have to go and check if they're even moderately accurate, right? And that process, the fact-checking process, the academic model that I learned, like, doing historiographical work on Shakespeare, like, that's going to be very, very relevant to, like, ordinary people. Right, who are using this in like it? A new skill set is going to be emerge, and fact checking is going to be at the forefront.
That's really interesting. You mentioned earlier the humanities education or lack thereof in among who we might call tech bros, I guess. Don't call them tech bros.
I mean, I don't want to. I like these guys. You know, I do like these guys. There's so much better than literary people. There's so much less cliquey.
Certain ways. Okay. Yeah. I take your word for it, but let me mention someone who might fairly be classified a tech bro, I think, who is Sam Bankman-Fried, founder of the recently defunct cryptocurrency exchange and crypto hedge fund FTX. And he said in an interview that he's very skeptical about books. I don't want to say no book is ever worth reading, but I actually do believe something pretty close to that. I mean, are you concerned that the world view of tech moguls is shaping our society and they may be averse to the humanities, to books?
Well, I mean, as I said in the piece, like, the social media era was an era where society and history were changed by people who had no understanding whatsoever of society and history. And I mean, I do find it fascinating how these these guys kind of assume that like humanistic questions are just like, they're just a matter of opinion. They're what you talk about over coffee when you're in between talking about serious questions. And that goes for even guys that I really like, right? Like some of these engineers are like, I mean, they're really fun to deal with, and they're so optimistic, and they're building things, and they're not cliquey like literary people. I mean, they're so much nicer in so many ways. But, you know, they think that like comedy and free speech, like a question like that is just everyone's entitled to their opinion. And it's like, well, actually, that's a very lengthy historical debate that has, you know, roots in 16th century, you know, in early authority of text predictions in the 17th century. You really need a historical grounding to have a really meaningful understanding of how to think through it. And it gets them into trouble every time. Treating very complicated problems as simple just because they're humanistic is a recipe for disaster. And I mean, it's not just FTX, bro. It's like Elon Musk on Twitter is like a classic thing. It's like you just don't like, if you read a couple of books about this and talked to a couple of people, you would know that, you know, there's a bunch of things to think about here.
Well, we've run out of time, but let me ask you maybe to recommend a few things for us to read. If we want to think a bit more about the schism that you're describing between the humanities and humanists and technology, what should we read? What's going to help us?
Well, I mean, you know, sadly, the big books are, the old ones are still true, like C.P. Snow, The Two Cultures, but also The Postmodern Condition, Lyotard. Right. Where it, like, you know, where he says that there's this divide between performative technologies and grand meta narratives of the humanities. And that's still largely true. But I mean, I would love, what I think everyone should do really is just go and use some of these large language models and go fool around with them and see what you can do. Cause I mean, I think there's going to be a whole explosion of experiments, both scholarly and literary, that are going to be, you know, fabulous. And I feel a bit alone. I've been alone with this stuff for a long time, but I want to see what other people want to do with it, for sure.
I want to see what you're going to do. Have you got a working title for the next novel written with ChatGPT, Stephen?
No, I don't think I would never write a novel with ChatGPT-3, but I mean, I've written a short story that's all prompts, right? Prompt Golem. And I'm still looking for a home for it, but I will find one. But there's I don't necessarily think it'll be novels. I think it'll be things like, you know, I've been talks to do a reconstruction of the Epic of Gilgamesh with AI, like the where it's like, you know, you can use artificial intelligence to recalibrate text, recalibrate these ancient texts. There's Shakespeare chatbots. Like, I mean, I've already seen a couple of them, but you know, the new ones are going to be unbelievable, right? You're going to be able to have a meaningful conversation with Shakespeare.
I thought you were going to say that the title should be A Portrait of the Young ChatGPT as a Young Megabyte, something like
that. Portrait of the Artist as a Young Machine.
Brilliant.
Artist as a Nascent Technology. That's not that.
We'll await it with bated breath. Thank you so much, Stephen.
My pleasure.
Thank you. That was Stephen Marsh. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared with me, Shahida Bari. Thanks for joining us.